regulars, the eclectics, and the physiomedicalists, just so you know these terms. You may have been exposed to those terms. The slides are on the portal, and I even put in more notes at the bottom, because I know that some people like my little notes at the bottom of the slides. So, where we left off in the herbal tradition, basically, was with Henry VIII. We left off in England. And Henry VIII, remember Henry VIII? I'm waiting for somebody to start singing.
Is it the second verse?
Yes, thank you. What was this?
I was singing it to myself.
Oh, you're singing it to yourself. Henry VIII, what was, from an herbal perspective, not did not happen here in the United States, of course, but from a medical perspective, what was he instrumentally doing? As long as you studied herbs, and you've had some study of it, you should be able to practice it. You shouldn't define it for practicing herbs. Of course, he did this with religion and everything else. If he didn't agree with the policy, he'll change it. So, in England, the next person that I wanted to talk about was Nicholas Culpepper. And there are some pictures of him on the slide. And he wrote one of the first books. He translated a lot of the herbal pharmacopoeia from Latin into English. This was important at the time, because then it made it more accessible, because who spoke Latin? The educated people, the rich people, not everybody, not the lay people didn't speak Latin. So he translated a lot of the works into English. And here's a quote. I say this every year because I just love it. I think it's kind of funny. I consulted with my two brothers, Dr. Reason and Dr. Experience, and took a voyage to my mother nature, by whose advice, together with the help of Dr. Diligence, I at last obtained my desire, and being warned by Mr. Honesty, a stranger in these days, to publish it to the world, I have done it. This was his preface to his book. Basically, what he was saying is that there's all this information out here. And you remember the arguments with medicine as well. Hippocrates talked about this. I don't want to talk about theory. I want to see what's an experience. And he said, okay, here's what we see from experience, but we also have to be diligent and test these things. And so he published the first book on herbal medicine. This was around 1634. So 1616 till 1654. He was not very old when he died. But it was the first step that he became had an apothecary as well. The next person who's more instrumental is... So he was first, because he took all these things and put them into English. Now he's available to everybody. Thomas Sydenham is the next person, 1624 to 1689, and he followed the vis medicatrix nature. He is really important because he looked at nature, the healing power of nature. He said that there was this healing power of nature again, so it was not in Culpepper. He didn't talk about that as much. He studied the herbs, and remember when we talked about homeopathy? And what was the major treatment for malaria, if anyone remembers, up until Samuel Hahnemann? Not very good. It was another thing. Quinine. Thank you. Quinine, when you get to homeopathy, that's going to be the main thing. Quinine. Peruvian bark, cinchona bark. And this is what set homeopathy ablaze, because Hahnemann saw that if you took malaria when you were taking cinchona, if you took cinchona when you had malaria, the symptoms went away. But a healthy person taking cinchona developed the same symptoms of malaria. So that's how homeopathy came about. But it was Sydenham who, in the 1600s, came up with the idea of using cinchona for malaria. So he's the one who introduced this. And so it was in his text, and then all these other texts. Cullen is the person that Hahnemann translated from. So we see that he started talking about the vis medicatrix nature, the healing power of nature, and the main goal of Sydenham was to encourage discharge. So he went back to some of the old Hippocratic notions. Fever was good, perspiration was good, and what happens when you take cinchona? You develop a fever, you perspire, you get out all of those things. So fever, perspiration, vomiting, diarrhea was healthy and a normal process. Think about this. When I work with HIV care, I think I mentioned this last week in one section. When my patients are on certain antiretroviral medications, as well as really intense antibiotics, and this is somebody who lost their hands. Now goes along. For instance, if your CD4 count gets below 200,
you do not CD4.
Your CD count goes below 200, the common treatment in HIV care is to be on trimethoprim sulfate, fluoxazole, TM, or Dapsone, or some strong antibiotic every day. Every day for the rest of your life until your CD4 count goes back up. Then, compounded with some HIV medications, many of my patients have diarrhea. And 14 bowel movements a day. I mean, literally. I mean, that's average of what I hear. Can you imagine what that's like? I mean, if you're awake 14 hours, what's that like? And it's not like every hour on the hour and we know it's predictive. It's walking home and I've got it right now. So what is the standard out of habit practice if you want to stop that up? So you get vomitil, imodium, something. Sinhan would say that that's the wrong approach. So what's the reason? Because what they would want to do in the traditional medical perspective is to stop it. What's the cause of it? It's a discharge. You're trying to get out something. So I never use those agents. Because you could use carrot powder. You could use carrot powder. It stops people up just as well. Eat a lot of carrot, you'll know. But then, of course, the day after the carrot runs out, and it can be more explosive. But it's the same approach. So using natural substances isn't necessarily good. What we want to do is look at the cause. So, and I've complained many times that I've helped people with chronic diarrhea without ever giving them something to stop the diarrhea. What Sinhan was also saying at the same time is that the fever, can you have a fever? Can you stop it? What's a scary fever?
104 and 105,
depending on your age, depending on your vital force. What's a scary fever? Maybe it's not so scary. So fever, perspiration, diarrhea, vomiting. Think about antiperspirants. What are we doing? Trying to stop the natural body process. So Cynthia back in the 1600s said that it's really important that the whole point, and this is important because this is one of the principles of naturopathic medicine, the disease is the body's attempt to throw off the morbific agent. So we see some people still use that, like the morbific agent. And so it's a natural process. So when you're sick, again, do you think of it as something to cure, to get rid of? Or are you trying to say that this is really important? This is how the body is, and it's telling you everything it needs to be well. So he mentioned that. Disease, however, this is a quote, much its cause may be adverse to the human body, is nothing more than an effort of nature who strives with might and main to restore the health of the patient by the elimination of the morbific humor. I watched what method nature might take with intention of subduing the symptoms by treating in her footsteps. Sinhan was, he graduated with a bachelor's in medicine and then went off to war and practiced as a surgeon. Because that's what you could do back in those days. You could get a bachelor's in medicine, and it was 30 years later that he became a medical doctor with a medical education. So, interesting. He said that disease, you have to take disease as a picture. So this is what we see in Hahnemann. This is what we see in homeopathy. You have to look at the constellation of symptoms. What most people were doing at that time is, at that time, so you had diarrhea, you treat diarrhea. You have a headache, you treat a headache. He's saying, it's this constellation of symptoms. There must be something more. It's the body's attempt to throw it off. So the headache and diarrhea might be the same thing, rather than treating the whole thing. Acute disease is the body's wholesome conservation and effort to heal the body. I just keep saying this over and over again because I want you to think about what do you do when you think you're ill? What do you want to do? Chronic disease, however, is, and they still have the four humors, is when the four humors get maligned somehow. So what's the difference between acute and chronic disease back in this time? Same with Hippocrates. What's the difference between acute and chronic disease?
Acute
How would you think about this? We could even think about this now. What's the difference between an acute disease and a chronic disease? Causative.
An acute disease. Well, a chronic disease would be something that goes on for a very long period of time.
Okay, so a time factor, chronic disease goes on a long time. How do you get that to happen?
You have an acute disease.
And what? Wait. Okay, so you have an acute disease that you didn't treat?
Body.
Respond to effectively. Because this is prepping us for next quarter. It's really important that you understand that. The acute disease in Sydenham's model, in homeopathy, and naturopathic medicine, is you have the acute disease, and the body didn't discharge it properly. It didn't have the full reaction. So maybe you suppressed it. You're going to hear cases next quarter. You're going to get cases every week, which are going to be interesting. You're going to hear about homeopathy and hydrotherapy, mostly as the main treatments. And many of you are going to say, really? This happened this quickly? This is how... Yes, it does. But the difference between chronic and acute is not just the time factor from our perspective. It's that the acute disease is either suppressed or it's not fully manifested. And as a result, there's been no discharge and the body just goes deeper. Classic case from the naturopaths. You'll hear in naturopathic medicine, eczema. You treat eczema with hydrocortisone as a child, what happens? Asthma. You often see the connections. It's atopic reaction. Skin outside, much better to have than the inside. That's deeper pathology. So, that's the whole idea between acute and chronic disease. I want you to stay with that. So if you think you have a chronic problem, can you even trace back where it might have been the acute disease? And remember, from a homeopathic perspective or modern naturopathic perspective, the acute disease could be an emotional trauma or some other trauma that you didn't deal with. Okay. So that's Sydenham. Sydenham's work really is instrumental in influencing a lot of other people. He took the herbs from Culpepper and some other people and took it in, talked about the four humors, talked about the vital force, said there was this vital force, started exploring with herbs, that the main thing was to discharge. Important. So, let's move to the United States. In 1760, the first place to legalize medicine as a profession was New York. And again, what was the main goal of that? Turf. Wanting to make sure who's going to be practicing. By 1830, there were 13 states that legalized the practice of medicine, and we've already talked about the AMA and their dealings. At the time, they talked about regulars and the irregulars, or the root or Indian doctors. Originally, the term was Indian doctors, and in a disparaging term, the root doctors, because of Indian medicine. Because what happened? People came to the United States, the settlers, and what did they need? They saw the Native Americans who were practicing and quite healthy at the time until we came in and introduced smallpox and cholera. The Indian and root doctors, many of these people, the settlers, not having medical doctors around, would go and study with the Indian shamans or medicine men of the area and learn about how to use herbs. So in Native American cosmology, again, there were three causes of disease. There's the human cause, the natural cause, and the supernatural cause, of course. So there are all those causes. The natural cause is what? Snake bite, frostbite, falling down in a ditch. Natural things that happen. Now, human cause, let's go back to Sydenham. Sydenham said the other aspect of chronic disease is overconsumption. We hear this again. This is the same thing as our Ayurveda says. That it's our practice of daily living, overconsumption, overwork, overstress. It's what we heard from the hydrotherapies perspective and the hygienic movement as well. Sydenham said that first. Overconsumption in the West. He said that. So human causes of disease are those kinds of things. Activities of daily living. What are the activities of daily living that are impairing your health? You don't have to answer that. Then we have the supernatural causes. The supernatural spiritual causes could be retribution by nature for disrespect. One of the examples was, is it the Navajo tribe? I cannot remember, and I apologize to anyone here, but urinating on a ceremonial fire. I mean, I was reading this. The gods will punish you. Why you would urinate on a ceremonial fire, I don't know. Improperly handling a dead corpse of a human or an animal. And that was almost specific for all tribes, which I think, you know, I personally like. How do you handle that dead animal that you use? Not very much like we do it now. It's like, oh, I just want to hide and throw it away. If you inappropriately handle that, so there's respect for everything in nature. That's what I really like. Spirit intrusion, soul loss, unfulfilled dreams and desires. The Iroquois talked about that. If you have these unfulfilled dreams or desires, that can't, if you're not following your dreams, and it's not like, oh, okay, I want to own Microsoft, but what my dream is, my vision quest. If I'm not following my vision quest, the spirits will come back and cause disease for me. Is that really hard to believe? How many of you don't follow what you want to do and wind up getting sick from it? So in several tribes, again, the medicine person, it depends. In several tribes, the medicine man, woman, healer was sent to help retrieve the soul when the soul was lost. I think it's interesting, in the Huron tribe, in the 1700s, the Jesuits priests, they had the belief that the Jesuit priests could see their people and steal their souls. So that caused a rift, obviously, when they were trying to convert them. So that started a lot of problems. What were the Native American methods for healing? So, like everyone at the time, across the world, there was bleeding. Bleeding was often used for fever and headaches. Interestingly enough, in acupuncture, many times, if you have a lot of heat that's not coming out, it will bleed you. Okay? Just a little small needle. And just getting that discharge can help for fever and headaches. Native Americans did that. They often use cautery and moxa, just like they do in acupuncture, burning the leaves. And that was for rheumatic pains and inflammation. Cupping, which they do in acupuncture as well. Isn't that interesting? In the Native American tribes and in China, they're doing cupping. In Unani medicine, you use cupping as well. Cupping, where you have... Has anybody seen it? I think I talked about it last time. You take a cup, and you heat, you get some burning heat, you put the cup on, and the cup creates a suction on the back. I mean, I remember the first time I had that, and I forgot about it, and I... Because it doesn't hurt. I didn't think it hurt. And then...
It did hurt? No?
Yeah, I had... It was probably for what she was it for, but I had... She put it over a place where I had a lot of nerve inflammation. That was a lovely treat.
I didn't... I didn't have... Did you feel better afterwards?
No.
Okay. It doesn't always work, though. But it's a Native American that it would have been better.
I think so.
I had it done on my back to just get the toxins out. So we pulled the toxins out, and I looked at my back and it was like purple for weeks. And then I tried to use that. It's like, I've been abused. Nobody cared. another treatment was enemas. Often use of enemas with herbs for constipation, diarrhea, hemorrhoids. Of course, like all traditions, dietary changes and fasting. And they talk about changing your diet with the season. Fumigation, steam, and smoke, we know about that. But the Plains tribes actually smoked echinacea. That was interesting. Massage with topical herbs, surgical interventions, amputations for lancing wounds. There is some evidence of dentistry, not much, because if you look at the dental plates of the Native Americans, they were quite healthy. But there were times when there were abscesses and they did pull some teeth. And again, we get a lot of our herbs. What are some herbs that we use for pain, for toothache? What did they use here? Clove oil, oil of clove, but they would chew cloves. What else?
Willow bark.
Willow bark. White willow bark, from which we get aspirin. And please remember, it wasn't until 1975 that they knew what the active constituents of aspirin was. 75. People were prescribing aspirin for pain, but they didn't know what it was doing, whether we really know what it was doing. The other Native American traditions were sweat baths, cold plunges, bathing and drinking from mineral springs, sanitation. There are records of the colonists coming to this country and being surprised by the hygiene and sanitation habits of the Native American traditions. Because another thing that they would do is when someone was ill, they would isolate them and put them in isolation because they had a sense that these diseases could be transmittable. So that was something new that we didn't see in the 1600s. Because remember the cholera epidemic. When did that happen? When did John Snow map that out? In the 1800s, yes, very good. So they isolated infected patients. There are the herbal pharmacopoeia in the United States, and I'll talk about who helped do that. They got 200 herbs. They had 200 Native American herbs that we use now today that had also been rolled into modern medicine. You know that modern medicine, 30% of the drugs are from herbal preparations, almost directly. Something that's not on the slides that I wanted to talk about. In 1837, when smallpox happened, the tribes were really affected. For instance, the Mandan tribe was affected the most. Their population was 1,600 in 1837. In 1836, it was 125. 1,625. The Mantarians were lost 500 out of 1,000. The Crow lost so many of their tribe that then they retreated up into the mountains, and once they retreated out and got away from Western civilization, they survived. I mean, so there's so many because of the smallpox, but that's that also. So when we talk about what we did, it wasn't just some of our practices, it was also the diseases that we brought with us from Europe and how that impacted the shape of the Native American tribes. So, we have these Indian doctors, we have these root doctors who went off, the people went off and studied with the Indian medicine people and learned about herbs. So the first one was Samuel Thompson. Samuel Thompson is instrumental. He was born in New Hampshire in 1769. He's considered the American Hippocrates. He didn't like what we call regular doctors, so he created a system. You could buy his book and his medicine kit of his herbs for $20. That's a good businessman. For $20, he sold over 100,000 of these. Back then, that's a good price, right? And his system was really based on, he went back to the four elements. Now, some texts talk about going back to the Hippocrates four elements. He really wasn't. He was talking about the four humors, the four elements from the Native American traditions. So he talked about the four elements. It was said by the time he was done with his system that about 1/6 of the population of the United States was using his system. And it involved herbs, and it involved diet, and it was based on the elements. He said that the cause of all disease was deranged state of the fluids of the body. His main thing was absence of vital heat, that you got cold. There was this one. Because we needed this. Remember alchemy again, when we go back to other things? That fire that digests everything. So he said that lack of vital heat was bad. So what he wanted to do, so this is what his system is based on, is encourage fever, encourage digestion. Because Pepsi, you're not digesting your food. You need vital heat here. You need heat. So he would do sweats. He would do anything to induce fever, herbs to induce fever, and digestive food. Because if your digestive fire was out, you're not going to digest and assimilate any of the nutrients. So what's the point of that? You're just eating, and nothing happens. So the other thing that was really interesting about Thompson is he would not let regular doctors study with him. He was anti-regular doctors, because again, their main thing was purging and bloodletting, using high doses of poison, and he didn't like that idea. He wanted to use nature. So any regular doctors, that's what they were called at the time, the regular doctors, and then his group became the Thompsonians, the Thompsonian doctors. And he said, nope, not going to let him, so he wouldn't sell his kits to anybody, he wouldn't let anybody study with him. At the very young age, he apprenticed with some herbalists, and that's how he learned most of what he did. Is there anything else I wanted to say about it? Cold was death. That was the name. So a few years later, Alva Curtis came around. Alva Curtis was a Thompsonian practitioner, but Alva Curtis, this is how things started to change. Alva Curtis, you know, there's something wrong here. We can't just do this. We need to combine.
they need to learn some of the stuff that the medical doctors do, because it wasn't very, in his terms, scientific. We want to study a little more. So he tried to play Thompsonian medicine with some regular medicine, and thought that medical training could be useful. So this is the term. So we have the Thompsonians, the root doctors, and now his group is called the physiomedicalists. So you'll hear about this. One of the things I didn't say. Do you know who the first, do you know the only MD who signed the Declaration of Independence? He was a regular doctor. He did not like the root doctors. He was really anti-root doctors. Although, root doctors saved more lives. Anyone know? Benjamin Rush. Okay, so next time you're doing Trivial Pursuit, that's... So we have the regular MDs, and we have the root doctors. Then when Thompson came around in the mid-1700s, they became called the Thompsonians. And it was based on his system. And you can find his book. I don't know if we have it in the library. I think we may. So Alva Curtis said we should combine both of these. And this was the development of the physiomedicalists. He developed a school in Cincinnati, which was called the Botanico Medical College in Cincinnati, which wound up becoming the Physiomedical Institute in Chicago. He taught the Thompsonian approach, and they developed further materia medica. And they combined the medical treatment and the materia medica. So now the materia medica of herbs started to include other medical conditions that they didn't have treatments for before, because they blended both. So this is in the late, this was, what year was that? I didn't put that down there. Mid-1800s. So physiomedicalism adopted on Thompson's theoretical framework, and because it was adopted and they combined the regulars, they first eliminated the four elements. So that doesn't make sense. So this physiomedicalist said get rid of the four elements. Doesn't make sense. However, they did talk about the vital force. They still said that there was this animating principle that needs to be addressed. And the main cause, whereas Thompson said the main cause of disease is lack of vital heat, the main cause for the physiomedicalist was the accumulation of toxins. Remember the hygiene? And what does that relate to Ayurveda? I'm not going to explain it. Does it know what that relates to Ayurveda? I mentioned this 5 weeks ago, which I know you should talk about. Anybody know what congestion is? What they call catarrh. The reason this is important is when you go to the homeopathy text, when you start repertorizing the homeopathy, some of the language is not modern. So if somebody comes in with sinus congestion, you can't look up sinus congestion. You can look up catarrh. That's congestion. Does anybody know the Ayurvedic term for catarrh? Accumulation of waste material in the gut. Ama. Remember ama? Yes. Okay, good. The difference between the physiomedicalist and Thompson was Thompson said you had lack of vital heat. What the physiomedicalist said is that when you have congestion, it blocks vital heat. So you have to open up and get the congestion. So elimination of toxins. How do you eliminate toxins? Like people. The physiomedicalists were opposed to poison in any way. So this is also important. This is in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So the difference is, they thought poisons of any form, any herbs, or any homeopathy, even though there's nothing of the original substance in it, was bad. So they were against poisons. So they didn't use those. You could look at William Cook's 1869, who wrote The Physiomedical Dispensatory and the Philosophy of Physiomedicalism by Joseph Thurston in 1900s. If you look at a lot of their teachings in their school, they're almost similar to what we learned here in the beginning. But we did close the pages. Then came the reform movement. There's always a reform movement, right? Yes. Okay. So we go from Indian doctors, Indian root doctors, to the Thompsonians, to the physiomedicalists, and then we get to the eclectic form. The eclectic form was a reform in the medical system where they took further Thompsonian training and regular training and combined them even more. And they would use homeopathy and herbs, but not bleeding and purging.
And this is in the late 1800s. The main thing about the eclectics is it's based on this idea of the system of substitution. The system of substitution is, instead of using poisons for something, what can you use that's healthy, herbally, in place of them? Now, how many of you think that's what naturopathic medicine is? Is that what it is? It's a system of substitution. You have a cold, so you're going to take Hydrastis. What happens if you take Hydrastis? We know that Hydrastis, from an herbal perspective, based on Chinese medicine, is very cold. What are antibiotics? They're very cold. What does Hydrastis do? It kills virally infected and bacterially infected cells. It also kills your normal gut flora. If you take Hydrastis for a long time, you can develop candida, just like you can if you take massive doses of antibiotics. So all that's natural is not good. But is that what you think that's what naturopathy is? You came here to learn how to use natural things in place of? That's the eclectic approach. But it's, and of course, not to purge and bleed people. Is that what naturopathic medicine means to you? Is that what you think? Is that what you're doing? You get diarrhea, instead of taking Imodium, you're going to take carrot powder. I think you should all play with that. By 1880, there were 10,000 eclectic practitioners that were learning. So they took Thompsonian's approach, all the herbs they learned from that time, studied medical tradition, but unlike the physiomedicalists that still did purging and avoided the herbs, they used the herbs in place of mercury, arsenic. So there's different schools of thought that's going on here. One of the first eclectics was Wooster Beach, 1794 to 1868. He studied with herbalists, later went to regular school, and opened the first academy, which was called the Reformed Medical Academy, and organized the first society, which is Reformed Medical Society of the United States. It opened in 1829 and closed in 1838. But then the society opened another school later. It was first founded in Ohio, moved to Cincinnati, and the goal was to bring a scientific knowledge of botanical medicine to the people. Because remember, their goal was to use herbs in place of poisons. The Reform Movement lasted, again, they called themselves the Reform Movement. They were medical doctors. They were medical doctors. They got the degree. Then came John King. He was an MD. And this changed a lot of things that happened. John King, 1813 to 1893. He helped found the Eclectic Medical Institute. He was a professor of obstetrics for 40 years. And what he did was, and we still use this, when they used herbs, how did they use herbs? Okay, let me back up. How did they use herbs at that time? Do you know what they did? You haven't had herbal medicine yet, right? What kind of herbal preparations do we have? Do you know? Tinctures? What's a tincture? Extracting an alcohol. What else? Teas. So teas, you boil it in water, whether you boil it or steam it or something. So you have teas. What else? Salves. What's a salve? What else? Poultice. Poultice. So where you are macerating it up a bit and then putting it, like what's another one that Native Americans used for broken bones? Comfrey. Bone set. That's what its name is. Bone set. You break a bone, they would put it back in place and put comfrey on it, and within a week, many times it would heal. Poultice. What else? Eating it. One of the main things that people were doing at that time was just ingesting it in raw form. What else? Burning it, smoking it, inhalation, that's Native American tradition. Yes, they didn't do that so much. Well, you do that every time you smoke cigarettes or any other stuff. Essential oils, which again in the Unani tradition, which was not in the regular tradition and not in the Native American tradition. Essential oils. That is what? That's a more complicated system, most complicated way to extract stuff from herbs that happened earlier than any of this
that when John King came, and this is in the late 1800s, came a different way of looking at herbs. So what people were doing, Native Americans, they weren't doing succuses so much, they made salves, they made poultices, they would ingest it, they would burn it, they would macerate it. John King changed our medicine, all of our medicine, because he was making podophyllum. He used podophyllum. Anybody know podophyllum? Modophyllum?
Can I still use podophyllum?
Usually it's a tincture. But why this is important is he started to make this podophyllum, what they used it for. Anyone know what they used it for? Podophyllum can be used for swollen lymph nodes now. I mean, it's different for deep wounds, infections that wouldn't heal, abscesses, tumors. What happened in this time is there were a lot of root doctors that were taking tinctures and they would make tinctures. They'd put the herbs and extract it in alcohol and then give it to people. And they didn't know what was in it. Well, sometimes they would just use the juice of it. And so around the time, this is also the detriment of our medicine, anybody who uses herbal medicine, is that there are hundreds of practitioners now saying, hey, I found the cure for this. Here's this juice. It was something that they put in. They didn't know what it was. And I said, here, use it. So they took, because they learned Thompson's herbs, they started taking this process and they extended it. And so there were cures for everything. All these elixirs, all these creams and salves. But King, one night, was making podophyllum, and, you know, it was working a little bit. But what he did is he left it overnight. And what happened, because what he was just going to do was make a juice. He left it overnight, and what happened is his resin came to the top. And I was like, well, that's interesting, because he didn't have time to make it. It's like all these stories. He didn't have time to finish it. He saw this resin and said, what is this? And then he began to look at the active constituents of it. So what happened with King is that they began to say, there's other active constituents in herbs. They didn't really talk about it. Remember, Hahnemann, just like 20 years earlier, was saying, cinchona was astringent, bitter, rubefacient, and this is why it works. But they didn't know how to extract it. So now they began to look at different ways of extracting the herbs, and it changed medicine. It changed herbs, because what are you going to want to do then? You see that there's this resin, and that resin's more powerful for these conditions. What do you do? Yeah, and do you need the rest of the herb?
No.
This was a shift. So think about this. Remember, we were talking about homeopathy. 1847 is when AMA was founded. 1845 was when the American Institute of Homeopathy was founded. Remember, people were against the regular doctors, because what were they doing in the mid-1800s? They were poisoning people and bleeding people. Then came eclecticism around the same time, and they said, system of substitution. Let's use herbs in place of drugs. Remember, the main thing that happens when you use an herb, rather than arsenicum, pure arsenic, you vomit or have diarrhea, which gets the body to get rid of it. So it doesn't go through the first pass of the liver, and it doesn't cause toxicity like you do if you take, willow bark. You'll throw up. You take excessive amounts of willow bark. If you take excessive amounts of aspirin, you don't throw up. You have gastric bleeding. 84,000 people die a year linked to aspirin because of gastric bleeding. More than any other drug. And the pharmacists have said to me, because I've talked to them about it, the pharmacists say, and that's underreported because they come in with a host of other things. So, I'm trying to put this in context for you. So medicine changed. Homeopathy was doing really well. Hygienics was doing well. Eclecticism was doing well. Because people wanted these safer approaches, you wouldn't die, change the medicine. So then when we get to 1900s, which Dr. Seth is going to talk about next week, homeopathy started to fall by the wayside, nothing except. And John King and the people that followed made things fall by the wayside because he prepared an alcohol extract, left it overnight, resin was floating, and he started using this in low doses. Low doses and seeing better results than when you just use the extract. People started thinking, I can now extract things from the active constituent. Take acetyl salicylic acid from willow bark. What's the detriment of that? So plant extractions and concentrations became really big. Started to shift our medicine. What is he missing? John Scudder, who's the next person on your slide, and I took a picture of him with his dog. I really like this picture. John Scudder. 1894, so still before 1900, Set wrote this book called Specific Medicines and wrote on specific diagnosis. And he said that the cause of disease, he said, forget all this, is that there's a disturbance in the vital force. It's not the economy. And he said, you can look at the constellation, not just the symptoms, and treat the symptoms. But the vital force is disturbed, and you want to treat that. And there are specific things. He didn't say doctrine of signatures exactly, but certain plants need this disturbance of vital force. So you have to know the plant. So we hear the same theme over and over again. There's a disease, there's a plant, it fits with that person. The thing that he was saying, and what other people who were still in the herbal, eclectic herbal tradition were saying, is you can't extract out. So I take acetylsalicylic acid. But what's the whole herb do? Does the whole herb have other protective mechanisms that prevent me from having liver disease from that, or GI bleeding? Are there other properties of the herb that we don't know? We're just taking one property out. How did the whole herb work? So Scudder was really saying that each herb has a specific energetics, he used a specific pattern, and he used fluid extracts, a one-to-one extract. You'll learn all about those. And he would dilute it sometimes. It was not based on homeopathy, because it's not based on the law of similes. He didn't say, I give this herb, he didn't prove it, meaning he didn't give 100 people this herb and see what symptoms they had, and then said, that's the symptoms, you can give that herb. It was more of intuition and other things that he saw. But we see the same kind of themes going on in medicine. That's the point I'm trying to make. And the reason I keep going back on this and harping on this is, where did this naturopathic medicine come from? Where did we get these traditions? John Scudder only used John Uri Loy, who was a pharmacist but supported eclecticism. So he let John Uri Loy actually make all his special medicines. And you can look at that. The Loy brothers became famous pharmacists. And that gets into the 1900s. I have some slides about Henry Lindlar, who was a rich, he was a German-born guy who decided to come to the United States to make his living. He came here and he lived in Chicago and owned lots of property, made milk, not millions at the time, but he was very successful. And then he developed tuberculosis, and he almost died. So what did he do? He went to Sebastian Knight back in, didn't you read about Knight?
Yeah.
And cured him. These cold baths, cold walking, and he cured his tuberculosis, which was unheard of at the time. Because if you got tuberculosis, you die. He cured him. And so Lindlar said, wow, there's something to this. I want to be a doctor. But the best way, like I hear many naturopaths say this, the best way to make a difference is to become an MD. He became an MD. Guess what he wound up doing? Doing all the nature stuff, too. He created the first sanatorium, huge sanatoriums, but he included x-rays back at that time, which probably caused more cancer, and all these other diagnostic techniques, but he did a lot of nature cure. You're going to read Lindlar next quarter. You're going to read a lot of his theories. But the theories overlap, so you should hear these. What I'm talking about now, you'll hear that from Lindlar. I'm not going to go into Lindlar more. So that gets us up to the 1900s. Review. Herbal medicine in Europe comes over to the United States. But the settlers came over first. They worked with the Native American medicine people. And so they developed this Indian or root doctors. And they all herb, the whole herb, in many different ways. They didn't do the fluid extracts and have this distillation process. Whole herb believed in clusters three causes of disease in the Native American people: human, nature, and spirit. Thompson came along and studied with these Native American traditions, and Thompsonian medicine developed using herbs. Wrote a book, wrote a medical book, $20 for a new practitioner, $10,000 by the end of his lifespan. Wooster Beach and other people who studied with him said, we need to bring some of this medical tradition in. So they started adding the herbs for these other conditions, but they still used the poisons. You have, that was the physiomedicalist. Then you have the eclectics, who said no, system of substitution. Not naturopathy, but the system of substitution. Don't mistake those. System of substitution saved many people's lives, because now we're not using chamomile, we're not using arsenic and mercury. And then medicine starts to shift, and then you'll see lymph. So what's going to happen next week, just to review this? Next week, you're going to have Dr. Jared Zeff, who's going to come and speak. And he's going to take us from 1900 up until last year. However, on Wednesday, we're going to have Joe Pizzorno come. So we're all going to be in here at 8 o'clock. And Joe Pizzorno is one of the founders of Bastyr School. He will talk about what the climate was like at the time he came here.
Is it okay to bring some people sit in on the class?
We used to do that when it was in the auditorium. There's going to be a lot of people who don't make it too many. I'm going to try to get it taped as well. So you're going to have Dr. Pizzorno and Dr. Zeff. Dr. Zeff was one of the first graduates. I don't think he came from NCNM. NCNM before Bastyr was out. So the following Wednesday, so then the next week, you're not going to have a lecture. You get a lecture next week? Not me, Jerry. The following week, you're not having lectures, reading day. That's the week we start our presentations. Did everybody get the form? And email it, and it's on the form now. It's on the self-assessment form. For those in my lab, I wanted to, and Dr. Liangle, wanted just a brief write-up of what you think you're going to do for your project. Your project's about the historical roots, however you want to do that. Okay. Is this making sense? And do you connect why this is important? Because the perspective you have, the philosophy you have, guide what treatment you take. If you think that naturopathic medicine is just a system of substitution, just find out what's natural. You could go and be an MD. Is there a different aspect to it? I'm not saying you agree with everything, but what brings you here? What do you think needs to be healed? How do you do that? That's why we're doing this.
I think the Nature Docs book is interesting, and also kind of the topic of the class, pretty much from like the 1500s on, but it definitely seems like it's not so much Nature Docs as it is Nature Docs in European male existence. Mm-hmm. Like, why aren't we just talking about any women that were like burned at the stake? Or why we're not seeing as serial shoes and what was going on.
This comes up all the time, and I do not want you to think in any way, shape, or form we are misogynists or think that women don't matter, because they do. The problem was they didn't write as many books, and there's not as many books about this. So what I want to charge you with is writing them. I want to. So you're going to read Lindlar, and 2 years ago a student got so upset about his misogynistic, racist, superior white male attitude, she rewrote all the chapters from a different perspective. Of course, we'd love to get that published. That is a problem. Again, the women were killed. They were ostracized. They couldn't go to medical schools. Then they could. The regulars didn't let them in. In Nature Docs, there is a one.
Yeah, one.
Yeah. So there is work to be done. I mean, because who is actually doing most of the work? Again, the Inquisition. The women were killed, and we lost a lot of that tradition. So, if you find something, please let me know, because we'd love to include it. And I don't really like the white male's attitude, but... Okay. Thank you. Go gently. Enjoy your drinks.